The bullpen of the Sox is holding strong. John Gerland had been getting screwed again. Toby Hall is set to return, and we might even talk about the no-hitter from Mark Burley, of course. I am Mario Scalise. That is Jason Gage. This is the Southside Sports Report, show number three in a row, week in a row, which is a nice sign. Jason, how are you doing today?
I am doing fantastic. The White Sox kind of let me down. You know, I celebrated my birthday, went to the Angel game, had a good time, and
your birthday.
I looked at the scoreboard.
Oh, happy birthday.
Gracias. Looked at the scoreboard, and what do I see? A 5-3 Sox lead in the eighth inning. Then what do I see? 5-5. And then what do I see? The bottom of the 12th, 6-5 final. It was kind of a tough start.
Yeah, Sunday,
or a tough end to the week, so to speak.
Sunday's game. And it was actually a good week overall. They dropped that first one against the Rangers, but they took the next two. Then they took the first two in that Detroit series, which was, at this time of the year, a pretty big series for the Sox. And they were on the verge of sweeping, just one out away from sweeping. It did not happen. Let's start with the beginning of the week, though. The first game, Tuesday, against the Rangers, they lose 8-1, and that was all offense, which really has been the problem for the most part this year. John Gerland had another solid start, got roughed up later on. I think he threw 5-6 innings to start the game, giving up maybe one run, and then gave up a few runs late in the game, and that was all offense. Then there was Wednesday's game, which, of course, was the no-hitter for Mark Burley. He ended up, I think they went 6-0. It was close to a perfect game. We're going to obviously talk about that. Thursday was another win against the Rangers. They closed out the series. It was Javier Vasquez going 6 innings, gave up 3 runs, I think. Then it was Friday against the Detroit Tigers, in which they won 5-4. Saturday, they had a huge comeback after giving up 4 runs in the first to win 7-5. And then, of course, Sunday's game, in which they blew a 5-3 lead. And they end up losing in extra innings. Was it 6-5?
That is correct. 6-5.
So, good week overall. Bad end to it. And the week started with John Gerland getting screwed by not having much help offensively. And it ends with John Gerland getting screwed by the bullpen.
Yeah, Gerland had it rough. I mean, he's pitched like he did 2 years ago in the World Series run, where he was arguably the most consistent pitcher on that White Sox staff. Gerland is pitching. He's pitching back, and he's taken back over the inside part of the plate, and that's what he did a real poor job with most of last season until he kind of got on a roll midway through 2006. And you got to like what you've been seeing out of Gerland, but you also got to sit there and go, hey, he had one game where he was in Oakland. He pitched fantastic, and Bobby Jenks blew the save. Then he had the game last week where he was pitching great into the seventh inning. He was pretty much lights out, and he even admitted he lost some focus as the game went going, and then Ian Kinsler got him up for a home run, and then the bullpen gave up a couple more when Sosa hit a home run, a late garbage home run, and that game was pretty much over because of the offense. Nothing to do with Gerland. Mm-hmm. And then today, Sunday, Gerland goes, gives up 3 runs in the first inning, and he did not look bad giving up those 3 runs. There were some well-placed balls, some good approaches by the Tigers hitters, but it was definitely more of a tough luck 3 runs than someone going in there and pitching poorly, which was the case in Saturday's game in Contreras' first inning. And then Gerland shut him down the rest of the game. Ended up going 8 innings. Didn't give up a run for 7. The Sox went to the pen in the ninth. Arshma got 2 quick outs. And then Thames came in, pinch hit with a runner on, and hit not a hanging fastball or anything, but Thames is a dead fastball hitter. He got 3 in a row that were called by Pierzynski, and he golfed it on out there into left center field for the tying home run. And then Nick Massett gave up a leadoff walk in the 12th inning. Boone Logan came in. Walked the first batter, so that moved the runner into scoring position. Placido Polanco dropped a single down the line that won the game, and it would have been a double had it had there needed to be Polanco going anywhere else. And the Sox lost, and that's the reality of it. And Canerco had some 8 left on base, 3 strikeouts.
Yeah.
It was a pretty rough game all around, and it's got to be rough on Gerland because he has a couple games that he should have wins already, and he doesn't have them.
He has nothing to show for it at all. I think what's his record going right now? His record is 0-1. He's got a 4.66 ERA, which I think that was mostly from his first start. Then, of course, in that game, his first start against the Indians where he got lit up a little bit. But that series was bad as a whole. So, yeah, he has not deserved much as what he's gotten. His last 3 starts have all been solid. He hasn't really either gotten the run support or help from the bullpen. So, although still better than what he did last year. Last year he struggled out of the gate big time. So at least it's a good sign that he's getting his act together. And like you said, he's throwing inside more, which is key for him.
And then, yeah, for example, when I talk about the inside part of the plate and what the advantage of being able to throw inside and throw inside good means, the hitters aren't going to be able to lean out and pull and hit with authority the outside pitches, like his outside changeup. And John Garland has a very good changeup, but when he's not throwing inside, his changeup's not effective because hitters are able to lean out, make real solid contact with it, and really abuse him. But even when you watched his start earlier on in the week against the Rangers, or go back to his start against Oakland when he was pitching in, because he pitched in, he's able to get away with mistakes to get out over the plate because batters aren't leaning out there. And all around, you just have a much better opportunity at success when you're able to command the inside part of the plate.
Of course, then there's also Mark Burley, who had one of the best games for the White Sox in a very long time, even going back to 2005 when they had many great starts. He threw a no-hitter and was just one batter shy of throwing a perfect game. That one batter was Sammy Sosa on a walk. But he justly and rightly just picked him off, I think, in the next pitch or one of the next two pitches. So very close to a perfect game, and I'm not sure if you were able to watch it. I'm not sure if you were able to watch it in full, but he just inside, outside, changeup, cutter, everything. He threw everything in his arsenal and pitched everywhere.
Yeah, that was one of the best pitch games I've seen in a White Sox uniform, definitely. I mean, that was better than Wilson Alvarez's no-hitter in, I think, 92. I think it was opening day when Alvarez threw that no-hitter, or was his first start with the Sox that season. I know that much.
Yeah.
And I kind of want to comment on something I saw on ESPN the next day. I'm a person, I watch Cold Pizza. It's a pretty terrible show, but I like my sports fix. And I can get up and I watch interviews that are on there. AJ Przinsky was on there that day. But Skip Bayless, or Skip Clueless, whatever you want to call him, he was on doing, you know, around the horn. Or not around the horn.
It's like first and 10.
First and 10. First
yes.
and 10.
Yes.
And he said it was one of the worst no-hitters he's ever seen. And
what,
I just want to put this out.
What was his reason?
His reasoning was that it was the defense helping him, and that there were all these hard hit balls.
That's
what I want to say is, did Skip Bayless watch this game? Because the hard hit balls, yes, there were a couple, but let me tell you the reality of a no hitter. A reality of a no hitter is, if you were going to throw a no hitter, you were going to have good defensive plays, at least a couple. I don't care who the pitcher is, how great he is, how great he's doing. In baseball, where you have 27 outs, and guys are going to make contact, especially against Burley, typically at least 20 times, that it's going to go in play and into fair territory, so to speak.
Yeah.
The odds of a ball finding a hole are great. You're going to have your defense show up and make a good play here and there.
And what's that? There have been many no-hitters in the past where I'm sure a guy has walked four or five batters, where he's had some deep fly balls to the outfield. And in Burley's case, I think there was one ball hit deep to the outfield in which Garland saved for a run. But there have been instances where guys hit shots to the outfield in which they're caught time and time again, and they walk four or five in the game. They face 32, 34, 35, whatever batters. He faced the minimum. He faced 20. He went as close as you could go to a perfect game as you can. So the fact is that it was a great no-hitter. He struck out 8, I believe, which was a solid number, but I think it gives a lot of props to the Sox defense. And for the most part, outside of a couple plays by Joe Creedy, outside of that play from Jermaine Dye, the balls that were hit just routine plays.
Yeah, there were four hard-hit balls in that game. There was the ball that Joe Creedy made,
yes.
Diving play.
He
threw out the guy at first base, Hairston, who got kicked out of the game. And Hairston was out. Replay showed it. You had Jermaine Dye going back to the wall and catching the ball at the wall. It would have been a home run, but you also have to remember Jermaine's a tall guy, and he just barely reached up over and caught the ball.
Yeah.
It wasn't an amazing play. It's a play most right fielders are going to make, most decent right fielders are. And then you had a ball that I think Ian Kinsler hit down the in between first and second, and Noguchi made a nice diving play and threw him out at first. And that was it. Every other ball was a very softly hit ball, right? You know, it was pretty much routine. And Skip Bayless went on to say that if the last hitter, Jared Laird, who was the final out of that no-hitter, had any speed, he would have been safe. For Christ's sakes, did Skip Bayless watch baseball? Did you see what Burley did? He completely jammed him up and got a little swing squibber over to third base. That is as soft as a hit ball as you could possibly have.
It almost seems
that is pitching good.
It almost seems some people want to see the no hitters by the Roger Clemens of the world. Just those power pitchers are going to strike out 15, 16 guys in a game and pretty much do it all on their own. And you cannot go and take down or make less what Mark Burley did on Wednesday against the Rangers. You can't do that. You just simply can't. It was a no-hitter. It was 27 batters on top of it. He walked one guy, and he picked him off on top of it. That just, he got so close to a perfect game. If he did not walk Sammy Sosa, would he have said it wasn't that great of a perfect game? Would he have said that? I mean, it's just such an asinine comment to make, and wow.
And I'm going to go one farther, and I'm going to say that's the second best game in Chicago baseball history in terms of a pitcher's and how well it's been pitched. And I realize I haven't seen all the Chicago baseball games, so I don't know in 100 years of baseball, maybe someone did throw a better game. But there's only one game that I can remember, and that was when Kerry Wood struck out 20 guys and had a one-hitter. They could arguably have been a no-hitter, but I think Kevin Horry made a play that he just missed. It was probably more routine. It could have been an error, if I recall, in that game. And that was the most dominant game. It was possibly the most dominant game I've ever seen in baseball history pitched. That performance by Wood, those curveballs he was throwing, was just absolutely unbelievable. And it's why Kerry Wood to this day still gets talked about in that breath, because he did for a long time have one of the best arms to come along in the last 20 years. You know, so did Dwight Gooden, but drugs got to him.
Yeah, there's no doubting or knocking Burley's start, and the next day was followed up by another solid Javier Vasquez start, and he's not going deep in the game, 8-9 innings, but he is holding up, and he's holding his own for 5-7 innings so far this year, and it seems like Guillen's doing a little bit a better job of pulling him and keeping away from those dangerous innings late in the game.
Yeah, he's definitely getting managed a little bit more closely, and part of me doesn't like that. But I also realize there's been a history of him blowing up later in ballgames. At the same time, I think that there's no reason with the amount of pitches Vasquez has, and he has more good pitches than anyone in the White Sox rotation, there's no reason with that type of arsenal and depth of pitching and stuff that you should not be able to get guys out the second and third time around the lineup.
Yeah.
And that it has to be a mental type block, and there has to be a way to get past that and get him to start getting through it.
Well, I think what you could maybe kind of take into account for last year is that he did throw a lot of pitches. While he was going five innings, it's not like he was getting hit around on 70 pitch count. He was still throwing 100 pitches. So whenever you're throwing a lot of pitches, you're naturally going to be using more of your arsenal. So come fifth, sixth innings, if you have five, six pitches to choose from, you might have already shown every single guy in that batting lineup that pitch, all those pitches. So come the sixth inning, it might be a little easier to get onto someone. Now, if he just goes and he establishes a fastball, let's say early in the game, and then later on he brings on his other pitches, he brings on his changeup or adds more, that's one thing. But he's got to first learn how to just get some quick outs early in that game. Throw, just live on a couple pitches early, and then as the game goes on, make some adjustments.
But here's my question. How much of that comes down to the pitcher, and how much of it comes down to the catcher throwing down the signs and realizing that? Because I know last year when Vasquez was struggling, he would get away from his changeup. And his changeup, and I agree with Hawk and DJ when they say how good his changeup is, because when you watch that changeup, he gets a lot of good action to it.
Yeah.
He has good arm speed on it, and he really fools guys. And there's no reason you can't consistently throw that changeup multiple times, not just the first time through the order. You should be throwing that second and third time through the order, because the changeup and fastball work off each other. So no matter how many times you see it, if you have the same arm speed, you're not going to have trouble.
You
is
know
Johan
what?
Santana's changeup less dominant the third time through? No. In fact, it's more dominant because he's so into your head at that point.
And really, and this might just be you could even correct me on this, but it almost seems like you could even go back to even Brendan McCarthy, who had, when he first came up, had a very good changeup. AJ Brzezinski just doesn't seem to call that pitch that much. You know, I don't necessarily know if I know Garland throws it, but he has a pretty good changeup, I think. Mark Burley has a pretty solid. It just doesn't seem like A.J. Brzezinski is one who's aggressively calls that pitch.
Well, I think he calls it because, I mean, you watch John Danks and he'll throw that changeup a lot. You watch Garland, he throws it a lot. Burley will throw the changeup. McCarthy would throw the changeup pretty consistent. I know when McCarthy first came up, though, he was tipping the changeup, and that was his problem. That was 2 years ago when he first made his debut. And McCarthy, he's had problems, you know, going to Texas now, too. So that's kind of a situation where he gets his arm speed out of whack. And he starts tipping that changeup, and guys just know it's coming. And then you're in trouble, because he gets a lot of the plate sometimes with that changeup. But I think some of it's AJ, but I think maybe, you know, we're not there. Maybe Vasquez is shaking it off, thinking, you know, I've had all this problem. I can't just consistently show the same pitch throughout the sequence, so he gets to throw something else that maybe it's not working. When you have four good pitches, 4 to 5, actually, I think Vasquez has 5, because he's got 2 fastballs, curveball, slider, changeup.
Yeah.
There's, you know, really no reason. You could stick with your 2 or 3 pitches that are really working, and then maybe show another pitch as just a garbage pitch with a 1-2, 0-2 count, and just show that pitch and just make sure you get that thing in the dirt or throw it outside for a ball, or go, if you're going to miss out.
Exactly, and if he's using all his pitches to get given out early in the game, that could obviously impact him later in the game. Now, Thursday. What happened on Thursday here, Jace? Let me try to catch up here up to speed since I'm tired.
Tuesday, Wednesday. Thursday was Javier Vasquez's start.
That was our Friday. Friday was Mr.
Johnny Danks. Mr. Danks.
And it was against Chad Durbin, I believe, which the Sox offense did kind of wake up a little bit, although it was against Chad Durbin and a Detroit bullpen that's been kind of very average and mediocre for the last few games.
Yeah, and Durbin did not pitch very good in that game, and the Sox offense left a lot of guys on. I mean, Canerco, the entire weekend, it seemed like he was hitting with the bases loaded and falling in a little short, although we had a big game Saturday, which we'll get to in a bit. And Danks had a good game. He pitched good. He's still lacking command, and we've now got to see Danks throw three games. He's gotten absolutely no support from the Sox. He got a little bit of run support finally on Friday. Looked like he may get his first Major League win. But then in the fifth inning, little pop-up with a couple runners on, with two outs. He was going to get him out of the inning, but there was a miscommunication between Mikowiak, Erstad, and Uribe. It looked like Uribe had called for it, and then it looked like, judging by Uribe's reaction, that someone had called him off, but no one was there for the ball, and it dropped in. Two runs scored, and then another runner ended up coming in on the play.
Yeah, and a play like that is even worse because it falls as a hit, and all those runs are charged for Danks. So you look at the box score at the end of the day, and you see four and a third, and four runs given up, and undeserving.
Yeah, and it's not that he's pitching great, but it's more when you watch him pitch. He pitches with confidence. He pitches quick. I had the Detroit Tiger feed on, and the Tigers announcers were really raving about the way he just goes out there and he works. He pitches with confidence. They kind of said it looked like, just by the way he pitches, that he's been talking and being around Burley, because they do have similar bit of mindsets out on the mound, and that they're pretty aggressive pitchers. They both work insanely fast, which helps you. I mean, the Tigers announcers were discussing about how when you work fast, you don't let the hitter get set and get comfortable, and that's a benefit to the pitcher, you know? If you have the hitter not ready for the pitch, obviously you're going to have a little bit more success.
I think it's positive, Danks, as a whole, just watching him progress, because I think he is doing what you expect a rookie to do. He's just going out there, he's throwing 5-6 innings, he's giving up some runs, but he's not, as you said, and as you said it last week, he seems very composed on the mound, and that's a very, very good sign.
And I still am very curious to see his development, because his command is not of a good major league pitcher yet. And I know he has good command for a guy that's 21 years old, but he's basically a fastball pitcher with a decent changeup right now, and his changeup has gotten a lot better, and it's starting to look more like it's got a chance of being a plus pitch. But his best pitch is a curveball. And he's very rarely been able to throw that curveball for strikes at the major league level at this point.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of time before he gets that release point on that curve and starts throwing that for strikes. And when you get that in there and he continues to pitch and get more experience and get more comfortable of working the ball, and I'd like to see him get a two-seamer that he can use to get in on right-handed pitching.
Yeah.
Because if there's one thing Danks struggles with right now that he doesn't really have the capability of, is getting a nice pitch and running it in on a right-handed batter, because typically he seems to struggle throwing across his body and getting the fastball in on guys. And if he can get that, then hitters have to look out at the whole plate. They got to worry about changing speeds between the fastball and changeup, and they got to worry about a big break that comes in looking like maybe it is a changeup, and then it dives on down, and you got no chance.
I think that's really the key for most pitchers, I think, is throwing inside. But for lefties especially, I think being able to take that fastball, even if it's just a straight fastball, and being able to shoot it right in underneath a right-hander's arm, I think that's a key pitch. You know, sticking with the Detroit series, they took the first two, as I've said. They dropped the last one. But through the week, the Sox did have some roster moves. One being Scott Pitsenik lands on the DL again with, what is the injury?
It's a strained abductor. And I can only think that means somewhere in the ab area. And it's unrelated to the groin, apparently, but it's a similar injury that he had, I think, at one point last year. Last year he had a groin injury, and I think he also had an abductor injury, or the abductor injury happened in 2005.
But the fact is this all ties into his speed. You know, it's not a shoulder injury. It's not even a back thing. It all ties into his running ability, which is what which is what he does. He's a speed guy, and it's just another thing that slows him down. And this is now the second year, the third year, in which he's had some little nagging injuries that tie into this.
Yeah, and what hurts is that Pesenna got hurt on an off day. I don't know. I'm assuming most everyone that listens to this podcast is pretty up to date on Sox News, but
it was a Monday. It was probably a Monday workout or Monday, you know, practice, whatever the case may be. And because Tuesday was when it was reported that he was placed on a disabled list, and it was a 15-day disabled list, but it could potentially be longer than that. And of course, Boone Logan was brought up as a 12th pitcher, which we're going to get into in the second segment. The whole idea of actually having 12 pitchers, but Sedek is out, could potentially be out for a while, which may or may not be a bad thing. You know, it's a bad thing in that he was being a very productive offensive player for the White Sox, one of the few, really. But now that he's gone, the Sox have kind of had a platoon of three guys in left field. Mikoviak's played a little bit, Ozuna's played a little bit. Actually, it says two guys because Brian Anderson continues to sit on the bench.
Yeah, and into that mix you have Darren Erstad, who at the time Pesenek was hurt had really been struggling.
Yeah.
And Ozzie had mentioned that Erstad was going to be moved down in the lineup, Pesenek was going to be at the one spot, and Gucci was moving up to the two spot. Pesenek got hurt, so Erstad ended up moving to the leadoff spot, and Gucci's back in the two spot. And, I mean, let's be honest. Darren Erstad had been playing pretty bad at the point, but I think it needs to be mentioned because I see a lot of people whining about Darren Erstad. In fact, I see a thread on Sox Talk that says, I'll pray that Kenny trades Erstad for a dollar bill. And let me tell you, if you think that trading Erstad and putting Brian Anderson in center field will make the White Sox a better team, then you obviously don't follow Chicago White Sox baseball. You obviously have not seen the jumps Darren Erstad's getting out in center field and the way he's played defense, because I have been someone that's lauded and applauded the fact that Brian Anderson is a plus defensive center fielder. He did a great job out there when he played last season. But the fact of the matter is, Brian Anderson's attitude is piss poor. And I realize Ozzie has not handled the situation that great. In fact, I've slammed Ozzie numerous times on this show for how he's handled the Brian Anderson fiasco. But Darren Erstad is playing very good defensively out there, and while he's been giving away a lot of at-bats and pretty much hammering everything into the ground in the second baseman, he's also came up with some clutch hits. He's also shown that he's healthy. And when he's healthy, it's just a matter of time until Darren Erstad hits 270, 280. And Erstad today went a little bit more with the pitches and started using left field. And when Darren Erstad is on, he will use all fields. He's a bit more of a pull hitter than you'd like him to be, a player like him to be, but he will use all fields. And Erstad is starting to pick things up. He's had a few clutch hits. He's a very good base runner. And I just can't get over the fact that he's gotten better jumps than any center field in the White Sox for the last few years. And that includes Aaron Rowan, who got pretty good jumps out there. Brian Anderson got pretty good jumps out there. But Erstad has been getting great jumps out there. In fact, fantastic jumps. And I would say the way he's played right now, he's played like one of the best center fielders in all of baseball defensively.
That's been the one positive from him in this early part of the season, that he's getting good jumps. And not even just from a defensive standpoint, but the fact that he's out there in center field and he's getting good jumps and he's moving around, he's playing pretty regular while doing it, it shows that he may be healthy. And for the first time in many years, he may be more physically in shape now than he was maybe 3-4 years ago. And that's a great, great sign, because you know he is capable of being a productive hitter. Like you said, he's able to spray the ball around. Today, Sunday, he had a little bunt single late in the game. He's able to do other things outside of defense. And I think if he's playing good defensively, it shows that he's physically in shape. Hopefully he could pull off into the offensive end. And I'm actually happy that he's been dropped down. At least Sunday he was dropped down to the bottom of the lineup with Ozuna leading off. And while I don't like Ozuna actually leading off, or I don't like Ozuna playing left field every day, that might be the best choice right now, because Erstad might be a better option late in the at the bottom of the order nowadays, until he at least gets into some type of rhythm. Because offensively, while he's had some good days over, I think this past week he's had a couple 3-4 hit games, for the most part he's given 0-for-5 and really not producing much offensively at all.
Yeah, he was in a major funk, but I also like to point out that with the Pesenek injury, Gucci moved up to the two hole, and we didn't have this slated to discuss on the show, but I've really noticed how Iguchi, he really is a two-hole hitter.
He's changed a lot.
I don't care what anyone wants to say, but he's getting good at bats. He's hitting the ball good. He's going with the pitches. Every once in a while, he's pulling the ball. He had a home run on Saturday's game where he got a pitch in and just drove the hell out of it, took it out to left field. And he's really looking good because when he was back in the lineup, his swing was slow. He just looked awful. And I think being in the two-hole forces him to be fundamentally sound at the plate, and it forces him to be a good ball player. And that's the type of player that Iguchi is, and there's no reason Tadahito Iguchi, unless he's hurt, should be anywhere but the number two hole while he's in a White Sox uniform.
Yeah, and that's pretty clear. You just watch his at-bats in that two hole and anywhere else in the lineup, and it's a big difference. And I kind of have a feeling, and this goes back to a couple years ago, I kind of have a feeling the reason he was actually put in the bottom of the order is not really because Guillen fully believes that he should be there, but I think Iguchi has wanted to be there for some time. I believe he wants to be down in the bottom of the order and show more of his power. But I think he's also that type of player where if you put him in the two-hole, he knows what he's supposed to do. While he may, I don't know necessarily if he wants to be there or if he agrees with being there, but he is going to produce as a number two hitter should produce, and that's a very, very good thing. And that's where he's most productive at, because he is he's probably batting close to about 500 since going there. He's getting one, two hits a game. That's the spot, and that's the spot that he should be in for, not even in the White Sox uniform, probably in any uniform that he is in his major league career. Now, going to Brian Anderson, because you were talking about his attitude, and it is a two-way street, because I think his attitude should always be positive, no matter what the situation is. He always should be ready to go out there and put it 100%, and I know this past week he had some comments about his career with the White Sox and his future with the White Sox, and essentially saying that he would be up. If they were to trade him, he would be okay with it, and that, you know, he wouldn't have any problems either way. Seemed kind of nonchalant about it.
Yeah. So as a whole, those comments aren't too bad.
No.
And I hate to step in because I thought you were done speaking, and it's something that, you know, we're gonna work on getting better at us talking to each other.
That's all.
But we're fiery. We're fiery people. But when it comes to Anderson, those comments, as a whole, I don't have a problem with the player saying, hey, I'd like to get some playing time somewhere else. But I have a problem with the player who doesn't produce, who pouts and whines, and really hasn't earned the right to demand to play somewhere else. Let's be honest here. It's one thing if a 7-year, 8-year veteran who's become a free agent and stuck around with his team decides, hey, I wouldn't mind going somewhere else. I was a starter for 6 years, and I'd like to be able to start somewhere else. And he gave it his all, and he played hard. It's one thing if you do that. It's another thing when you come up with the organization, you get here, you get handed the job, you don't work hard enough, and it's been well documented the fact that he was not exactly always there last year in the clubhouse, so to speak, that he wasn't always in the game, that he wasn't always watching the adequate film, and that he was trying to rely on the talent and the natural ability he had. But you know what? In the major league level, every single player has some kind of natural ability. That's why they're there. And you have to do more things. Yeah. The greats, Tony Gwynn, would watch film left and right. You know, all the great players had to do extra. You can never rely on talent.
You have to separate yourself from everyone else. And that you could say that's one thing he hasn't done. I know from an organizational standpoint, when you look at the Sox and the future of the White Sox, you like to see them develop. And I think that's one thing why I kind of backed Anderson somewhat over the last couple of years, is because I feel, you know what, the Sox should develop every year, every 2 years. They should bring in a guy and develop him and be patient with him. At the same time, this is a White Sox team that they're trying to win right now. You could tell by the money that they spent over the last couple of years. You could tell by the approach that they're taking with guys like Burley and Creeding. And I'm basically saying, you know what, let's try to win a World Series now, and then after this year, kind of just retool in a way. At the same time, this team is trying to win right now. It's trying to win this year, and Brian Anderson has to produce in any capacity, and it just doesn't seem like he maybe wants to do that. Seems like he wants to be put in a starting position, and like you said, it's fine if you want to go somewhere else, but he's got to put his time in at the same time. Last year, while his playing time was sporadic and while he probably didn't deserve the treatment he was getting from Ozzie Guillen, the guy didn't produce at the end of the day. He did not produce, and he was given a decent amount of time to produce, and he didn't. So it's all on him at this point.
Yeah, and this season, and you can't. You got to earn something before you get something.
Especially on a team like the White Sox. If you're on the Royals, you can understand. Listen, they're going to be. They have been bad, and they probably will be bad for a few more years while they develop. You know, quote unquote. You know, develop whatever they're doing over there. So a guy like Brian Anderson on the team is fine. But when you're with the White Sox and you know what they're trying to do, and you know that they're seriously trying to win and compete in a very tough division, on top of that, you have to take whatever role that you're given.
And when you don't produce and you don't put in the effort, you pretty much deserve what you get. And I used to say Anderson got a raw deal, but I think he's got himself into this situation. And maybe he'll get himself out of it. Maybe he'll see the light. I think Ozzy's given him a lot of tough love, so to speak, and Ozzy's treated him a lot tougher because of the way that he sees him acting in the clubhouse. And only him and the coaching staff and the rest of the teammates know this. So this is something that we kind of get from an outside perspective. It's really hard for us to know really what goes on. But reading between the lines, that's the way it looks. And as much as an Anderson backer I am, he needs to shut the hell up, play baseball. And if he wants to whine, then he can sit his ass down in Charlotte, get at-bats there, wait till he becomes a minor league free agent or uses his options up and go somewhere else, because the White Sox are not going to trade him when his value is at an all-time low. And the reason that value is at an all-time low is because of one Brian Anderson, Ozzie Guillen.
If you had to make a prediction right now, does Brian Anderson have any type of career with the White Sox?
I hate to say it,
I'm not talking
about
a slight chance. I'm saying if you had to make a prediction and say, what is it? Does he have? Is he going to be with the White Sox for the next 2-3 years?
I think he'll be in the organization because I don't think they're going to get rid of him unless some team comes in and offers value, unless you can get the type of Joe Borchardt for Matt Thornton where the Sox are getting a guy that has kind of had a raw deal where he was at and can get him over with some talent and see if a change of scenery would work for him. Then maybe I could see the deal getting worked out. But otherwise, no. I think he'll have a minimal career with the White Sox, and maybe 5-6 years down the road, he'll show up and play for some other team and actually go out and do something and be a regular player. He'll get time as a defensive outfielder from here to there, but I'm very beginning to really doubt the fact that Brian Anderson will ever do anything. The Sox like Ryan Sweeney a lot more. They like his attitude. They like the fact that he's actually got a pretty textbook swing, a pretty good approach at the plate. And while defensively he's not as good as Anderson, he has a lot of the tools that Anderson has. And he's going to be a pretty damn good ball player. And when Anderson, in a year from now, if Anderson's not there, you know, obviously Sweeney's going to be ahead of him anyway. So why would Anderson get the opportunity? It's just not going to happen. And we're going to see Luis Torero very soon in Chicago.
Ooh.
You can book that one. Well, Brian Anderson will be on a one-way ticket to Charlotte. The only question is whether Torero's coming up or Boone Logan's going down. And we're going to discuss that in the second segment.
Yes, and we're going to actually take a break now. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about Toby Hall, who is miraculously on his way back. Not soon, but he is on a pretty good schedule. We're going to get into that pitching staff a little bit more. Talk about that bullpen in particular. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Southside Sports Report. I'm not even sure what you actually listened to. You might have just heard some music. Maybe it faded out. I'll figure that out. There's no commercials, though. If you want to put a commercial up and give us money for it, we'll gladly take it. And you could reach our illustrious and large listener base of 10, 12 people.
For example, if you want to know what a commercial would sound like on your show, it sounds a little bit like this. Do you want to follow the Chicago Bulls on one of the premier Chicago Bulls message boards? Then come check out TalkBulls.com. The Bulls are up 1-0. Are they going to sweep the Miami Heat? Do we know? Find out there. Check in. Follow the games all throughout the season.
Yes.
You have the NFL draft this weekend.
Ooh.
Where is your headquarters for Chicago Bear fans? TalkBears.com. And for anyone that follows that sport of hockey, Bill Wirtz, I hear there's a rumor he may sell the team, and Chicago may actually get a hockey team back. You may be able to see the games on TV if that happens.
I don't know. I hear that's one strong thing that a new owner will keep is he loves the philosophy of keeping the game away from fans.
Mm.
Excellent strategy.
Mm. So is this new fan going to be like Adolf Hitler? It's got to be. I'm going to ban that. I'm not comparing Bill Wirtz to Hitler. Good God, I'm going to get frickin' imist. Oh.
I'm going to get imist. I like that. I like that term. You're going to get imist. Jason Gage has been imist. That's a very, very good term.
We gotta quickly switch the subject. Something.
Toby Hall is set to return soon, maybe May. He had his bullpen session over the weekend, Saturday. Actually, was in the bullpen, was able to catch the ball, was able to throw the ball, pain free apparently, and what looked like to be a season long injury potentially. He's now back in May, and this is a very good thing for the White Sox because he was brought in to be not just a backup, but to be a very good backup. Because when you look at his career with the Devil Rays, you've always kind of seen him as just a good catcher. You put him in the White Sox as a righty behind a lefty Brzezinski, and he could be a very, very good backup. And the Sox, if he comes back in May, they might actually be able to give A.J. Brzezinski a day off.
Yeah, it'll be a great asset to have a guy that actually deserves to be on a Major League roster. Because let's not mistake anything. Gustavo Molina is not one of the Molina brothers. And because of that, he's not a Molina that deserves to be on the Major League roster. The guy is a AAA, AA fodder. He's not a Major League ball player. He doesn't deserve to catch the likes of Mark Burley.
But don't criticize that. I mean,
I guess it's not his fault.
He's not his fault.
Right situation.
Yeah, he was in a tough situation. He's really a third-string catcher. I mean, a third-string catcher on a team in which you have A.J. Brzezinski as a starter who's a very good catcher himself, or a good catcher himself. So I can't really blame Gustavo Molina for this, although I kind of like the name. I like Gustavo. I think that's a pretty cool name. But Toby Hall will be returning, and it'll be exciting because he has the ability to hit some lefties, apparently. He's very good at hitting the lefty pitcher, which the Sox, historically almost, I mean, maybe not historically, but at least over the last few years, they haven't been able to do.
Yeah, that is going to be a big asset because you could put him at Pablo Azuna at the top of the order. You get Toby Hall in there, and then you take away two bats like Pasednik, for example, even though he's out on the disabled list. But like Pasednik and A.J. Brzezinski that notoriously struggle against left-handed pitching, mm-hmm. and turn those into strengths against left-handed pitching.
Yeah.
And that should do wonders for the Sox record against left-handed pitching.
And then, of course, the downside to that is that you're then going to have a lineup full of right-handers, which works against some lefties. But, and I think I said this last week with Santana, you put a guy like Santana, even if it's Ozuna and Toby Hall, he's going to have a success against them with so many righties in the lineup aside from what would be a Jim Thome and maybe an Erstedt.
Plus, historically speaking, left-handers hit Santana. He's one of the few pitchers that left-handers hit better than right-handers. So it's actually wise to have A.J. Brzezinski and Scott Pasednik out in the lineup. Plus, I wouldn't even have a problem with Pasednik or Pablo Azuna playing for Iguchi, because I think when you play a guy like Santana, and we discussed this all last week, so I'm going to make this real short and real quick, is the fact that you need every type of speed, every type of asset that you can finally somehow give it a run against Santana.
Because that's all you're trying to do. You're not trying to score 5-6 runs. If you can, great. You're just trying to score some runs, and hopefully the pitching matchup, the guy you have on your side, is capable of shutting down a Twins lineup, which, while they're a little bit feisty, you could hold on the Twins lineup for a few innings, or at least enough. Now, Toby Hall will be catching a surprisingly, at least in my case, a surprisingly good bullpen of the White Sox. I was kind of critical of them before the season, or maybe not critical, but I had a lot of doubt regarding to them and coming into the season and being consistently effective, throwing strikes, and for the most part they've had. And let's start with David Ardsma. He pitched Sunday, pitched in a closing in a save situation late in the game, ended up blowing that game. But overall, that game, he did pitch good. Got the first two outs rather quickly. And like you mentioned, he had that pitch to Marcus Thames, which wasn't a great pitch, just not a pitch you probably should have thrown to Marcus Thames. Overall, though, aside from that, he's been very, very productive. He's been a very, very bright spot. And when you look at that trade with him and Neil Kotz, it looks like both Chicago teams are getting good ends of those deals.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, David Zarzman's got a good fastball. There's an article on the Tribune today talking about how he's really developed his split finger and slider, and that's given him the secondary stuff to really succeed consistently against Major League pitching, and he's got a good fastball. This kid's pretty good. He definitely had a rough game, but when you have 18 strikeouts in just over 11 innings,
yeah,
that's impressive.
And I really hope that as a result of Sunday's game, as a result of Sunday's blown save, that Guillen doesn't feel that Ardsma can't pitch the ninth inning. Because I don't think that was a result of him being unable to close out a game. I think it was just a result of Carlos Guillen taking a very good swing and Marcus Thames just launching a ball into left field. Overall, he pitched good. And, you know, with Bobby Jenks, he's been pitching a lot lately, so it was good to get him a rest. I hope that sometime next week, or maybe, you know, come Thursday, Friday, the Sox are playing and they got a lead in the ninth inning and Bobby Jinks has been throwing, don't hesitate to put him out there. And I hope Gein doesn't get into that. Now, if he does it again, if he comes on next time and he struggles in the ninth inning and he doesn't, obviously you maybe have some second thoughts and maybe you just make him into that late inning reliever who doesn't close games. But I hope Gein just doesn't just label him as this guy who cannot finish out a game.
What I did think was interesting on Sunday in Sunday's game was the fact that the White Sox went to Boone Logan in that situation with the leadoff man aboard in the 12th inning, as opposed to going with a guy like Matt Thornton, who, while he's pitching 8 games for the Sox this year, he's only thrown 4 2/3 innings, and he had a rough game or two, but he's looked pretty good. And I kind of wonder, maybe Thornton has had some type of arm soreness or tightness that they've been very careful with him out of the pen, because I'm thinking there has to be some type of reasoning that the Sox haven't went to him as much as they did in prior years, so to speak, in last year.
Well, unless they're lumping just him, Cisco, and Logan together into this thing, listen, we got 3 lefties, they're all pretty much on the same playing field right now, and we're just gonna go with Gein will go with his gut, so to speak, and maybe his gut is just leaning towards Boone Logan.
I mean, earlier in the show though, we discussed John Danks, and I think it's a good enough time. He's pitching 5 games now for the Sox. He had a big game where he relieved Mark Burley early in the season when Burley got hit with against the Indians, and we got the win. And Massett was the other part, the other big piece.
Yes.
And Massett was advertised as having Bobby Jinks type stuff, a rocket ship of a fastball. And so far, his velocity has not been 98 mile an hour, but neither has been Bobby Jinks.
I know.
And Jinks has been successful. But Massett has shown great movement on his pitches. I've gotten to watch now a few of his games, plus some spring training outings for him, and I'm starting to get an idea of what Massett is capable of. And I'm impressed, and I want to see if you've kind of noticed the same thing. But when this guy throws a fastball, it doesn't look like he's throwing very hard, like he's throwing to the maximum of his ability, yet it's still hitting 94, 95 on the gun.
I would agree. Typically, he does have a good speed on his fastball, and I don't think he necessarily need to throw 98 because he seems to have some decent pitches aside from that. So I've been impressed with him overall. I think, once again, for a young guy, a guy like Bissett, who maybe in some cases, maybe if he was still with the Rangers, maybe he wouldn't even be in the bullpen for them. For him to come up and pitch as he has, I think it's a nice step. I think for both guys, I think just from a development process, it's been nice to watch them.
Oh, yeah. I've had a lot of fun watching this bullpen because one of the things I like personally is watching pitchers develop. I've got to watch John Danks make a few starts. We're going to get to see him mature. And I think with Danks' ability, we already said earlier on in the show that we're going to get to see this guy turn into a pretty special pitcher on the south side of Chicago over the years. And it's going to be great to watch him grow and see how he does now and watch him, you know, 2 months from now in the rotation and see just the type of strides he's made. And then a year from now, the type of strides he's made. Kind of like we got to see Mark Burley and John Garland grow up and then win that series in 05 for the White Sox as part of that rotation. And it's really fun to see these homegrown guys because from a fan perspective, when I see Garland pitch or Burley pitch, I think of them almost as like the Sox family because they've just came up. We got to watch them for so many years.
Yeah. And whenever you're able to develop your own players, that's always a great sign for an organization, even if those guys are making big bucks now. And I know I personally like to see that because I'd rather see a team do that and develop. Or even if they don't develop a guy like Nick Bissett, the Sox didn't develop, but they brought him over from the Rangers. Or John Danks, they bring him over from the Rangers. Even guys like Cisco and McDougal, they bring these guys from teams who really not many teams really even care for these guys. They bring them in. Now they're productive major league pitchers, and that's always nice to see because that's an organization that's thinking. That's an organization that is taking some chances and developing on their own, and that's always a great sign as opposed to just going out there and simply grabbing the best pitchers on the free agent market.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely a creative sign. I mean, Ken Williams has shown that he's not afraid to make moves. He's not afraid of what the fan base thinks because just think back a month and a half, 2 months ago, it seemed like so many parts of this fan base were ripping the Brandon McCarthy move, ripping Freddie Garcia move. And now what's happened? And it's way too early to judge this.
Yeah,
I'm just saying
at
this point, you know.
Well, you know, I liked the McCarthy move just because you're getting two arms for one. And while I did like McCarthy, I wasn't overly impressed with them. And in looking back, and I think I brought this up on the show, it almost seems like Kenny Williams kind of overhyped him in a way or, you know, made his value seem a little bit higher than it actually was. And then you look, but that Garcia trade, though, even though Garcia is hurt, I still really don't care for that trade. I think they could have gotten a lot more. I think Kenny Williams did kind of mess up on that end, but I think he more than made up for it, at least so far. And at least that's what I'm thinking for the long term. I think he's made up for it with this with the McCarthy move.
Yeah, but I just think it's interesting to say that when it came to the Garcia trade, I think Ken Williams knew exactly what he had in Freddy Garcia, and he thought the rest of baseball knew what Freddy Garcia had. But I remember reading reports of how the Phillies were absolutely shocked that he didn't throw 93-94. It's like their scouts didn't watch any of last season when he never hit 91 mile an hour.
I thought I honestly felt that coming into this year he was going to throw 93-94. But if you're a guy in an organization and you see last year, like if you're watching baseball last year, he was not throwing hard at all. It was late in the season where he was probably throwing about 88 at in some games, and he was simply just pitching his way out of games. He wasn't really – he didn't have any type of overpowering stuff. So if you're an organization, you can't trade him and expect him to throw 90. You could maybe kind of think he may and maybe hope, but you can't just expect that. And if they were expecting him to throw 94, got to question what the Phillies were thinking.
Hey, but I mean, what are the Phillies thinking? They have one of the worst managers in baseball. They have a very talented team, and they put Brett Myers into the bullpen. And I know we're a White Sox show, but they pretty much shown they're a stupid organization. Stupid with two O's, no P, no U. Like A Stupid Radio. Like you can listen to this schmuck that I'm with, Mario Scalise, on A Stupid Radio. .com or something, some of that such. 360thepitch.com.
I'd like to consider myself much more effective than this, and I feel bad for you because I don't really do that good here. And this show I've been kind of just stumbling and mumbling my way like I typically do, and you're holding us up once again. And I hate to give you credit because you're a jerk, but I got to give you credit. You've been holding this show up for 3 weeks.
I bring enthusiasm.
And it's probably going to go to your head because you're already arrogant as it is, but that's the truth.
In fact, I think next week's show, we're going to start calling me the Godfather because I run this family. I run the Southside Report family.
So
I control this whole thing.
Am I a brother?
Yeah, you're a brother. We'll see what happens. We'll see if you get whacked on The Sopranos tonight. these lame duck performances these last 3 weeks.
Yeah.
But speaking of bad things,
Go ahead. Go.
Okay. Talk. Interrupting the Godfather, that deserves...
Well, I was going to simply say, we're going to try to do things differently in this show because it wouldn't be right if the listener just heard me stumbling my way through a show every week or heard you talking yourself up so highly every single week if we have a little mix of people. So next week, either me or you will be gone. One of us will be out taking a break. We'll maybe bring in an Alex. Maybe we'll bring in a blogger. Maybe a Sox talker. Maybe you, a Sox talk listener, would like to come on the show and what is it? Show up? Is that the right word? Show up, me or you? With their White Sox knowledge.
Maybe we'll pull one of us will never have to come back to the show because the next person comes on is so great that we never need a Mario Scalise or a Jason Gage.
You know what? If that comes to that, I have no problem.
We'll be Wally Pipped.
But I don't think it will. I don't think it will go that, and we'll have a nice little rotation going, and I think it'll go good. Now, you were talking about some bad news.
This is kind of like a little Major League Baseball segment, but there was some bad news in baseball this week when the young superstar King Felix Hernandez got hurt. There's nothing I hate to see more than when young pitchers with dynamite arms, dynamite potential, guys that outdueled Mr. ESPN's Daisuke Matsusaka, and then they get hurt their next start. When they get hurt, it's just a bummer to see.
And I usually am happy in this case, if I actually called it, but I didn't call it. I didn't think Felix Hernandez would have these type of problems, and he does, and it's unfortunate. But you know what?
Life goes on.
Life goes on. I mean, it's not like it was a freak thing. He's the one who had the ball in his hands. He's the one who threw it. He's the one who obviously threw the pitcher who's been thrown the wrong way, and it caused him an injury. And, it happens. He's going to miss two starts, though. Maybe it just might be a precautionary thing. Who knows if the Mariners are doing a Cubs now, and they're just figuring, he'll be okay, and before you know it, he's out for the season. But it seems like it might just be a precautionary thing, and he'll be back.
It seems like they're going to be careful, and you got to be careful. He's 20 years old.
Yes.
He throws 100 miles an hour. He one-hit the Red Sox, a very good offensive team.
Mm-hmm. And I think and maybe this might actually be a wake-up call because you know what? Let's say he didn't get hurt. Let's say he pitched a season, and let's say the Mariners kind of got swept up in his just awesomeness, if you want to say. Yeah. I mean, he is a very, very talented pitcher at such a young age, too. And let's say he went out and threw 200 innings this year and was competing for the Cy Young. And let's say that just caused his arm to even screw up even more. And before you know it, next year he doesn't pitch at all. So maybe this is actually a good thing. Maybe it was kind of a wake-up call to say, you know what, take it easy on him. Relax a little bit. You know, if he's in the sixth inning and he's got 80 pitches, it wouldn't be a bad thing to pull him. Give him some nice, easy starts. Because he doesn't have to go out there and throw 110,
just like the Twins.
120 pitches every single time. If you want to go out there and say, you know what, this game, maybe every three starts, you're going to be on a 90-pitch count. You're going to be on an 80-pitch count. Watch him a little bit more. Because you know what, while the American League West is not a great division, the Seattle Mariners aren't really going to do much. And even if they do compete, they're not going to do much in the playoffs. So just back off. Let this kid develop, and if he does develop, because he has the potential to be a very, very good pitcher for a very, very long time, if you develop him right, you could have an ace for a very long time. So just be patient with it and let that come.
Yeah, don't pull a Minnesota Twins and have Liriano out and kind of bring him back when he shouldn't have been back, and then he's pretty much going to be gone for most of the season. I'd be surprised if he ever does anything.
With the Liriano thing, that was a Twins mistake, not for overthrowing him, because I don't think it was an overthrowing thing. I think it was just a mechanics thing, and I think the Twins just completely dropped the ball on that. They didn't see it. Liriano didn't figure it out, and I think that's what eventually killed him, because they could have had him throwing three innings a game. It was going to happen to him. So that was just something. It was in the future. It was in the plans. It was going to happen. It was just a matter of when. Hopefully the Mariners can really, really take care of Hernandez, because 2 years ago, I know last year he struggled, but that first year, I think one of his first few starts was against the White Sox, he was just unbelievable. And he's one of the few pitchers who he's able to keep the ball down and be a sinker ball pitcher, a ground ball pitcher, and then the very next inning blow guys away with a good fastball. And guys like that just don't come around often.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And from a guy that's a future potential Cy Young Award winner, a guy that was on the White Sox organization, a big fat man, Bartolo Colon, came back to Anaheim yesterday. He threw seven innings, gave up, I think, a run, and he looked good, real good. And it was good to see the big man back, because he's a fun player to watch pitch. He throws hard. He's the type of guy that when he would rear back and throw a fastball, he'd immediately turn around and look at the radar gun to see how hard he threw the ball.
Well, it was always fun watching.
He's back pitching good.
It was always fun watching Colon, you know, when he was with the Indians and when he played with the White Sox, and just the fact that he was able to throw harder in the eighth inning than he was in the second inning, which was just amazes me. And that's just how big he is, and he just has so much power, throwing 94 one inning, jumping up to 98 in the later innings. That's what made him such a productive pitcher. And if he's back, and if he's healthy, while the Angels' rotation is very, very good as it is, that's only going to help things, because the Angels have struggled in the early part of this season.
The Angels have been very similar to the White Sox in terms of
pitching,
one
no
bad
hitting.
Series of pitching. And that's the Red Sox series for them. It was the Indian series for the White Sox. And just an absolutely atrocious offense. Because the Angels' offense is horrible. And their offense isn't going to get better. The Chicago White Sox offense will get better and will be one of the best offenses in the American
League.
And
they're two different offenses, too. The Angels rely more on running and doing some smaller things, whereas the White Sox, it is leaning more towards the power base, at least now, because it seems like I should have actually kind of looked this up, but I would bet a good percentage of the Sox runs now are being scored on the long ball.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a good percentage. It's more than a good percentage.
It might even be one of the tops in baseball, which is kind of scary, especially considering they're struggling so much. And hopefully they can figure it out, because Paul Konerko has struggled. I think he's right around 200. Jermaine Dye is right around 200. Even Joe Creedy, yesterday he's maybe signs of him coming out of his slump, the last couple of days at least, because he had that big at-bat in Saturday's game, I believe, late in the game. He had a big RBI single, so maybe that's a sign of him kind of improved. But that middle of the lineup has struggled. So if the Sox get going and they hit up to their capabilities and the rotation pitches the way they have, they could be very well catching up in this division, although the Minnesota Twins are still in first place. And Jesus Christ, that team, they're not going to go away, and they're going to be up there.
The Detroit Tigers are in
second,
the Cleveland Indians are in third, the White Sox are in fourth, and the Kansas City Royals are in fifth. And the White Sox will head to Kansas City next week.
Yes.
On Monday, I think they play the next. No, Tuesday they play. They have an off day tomorrow. They get to play the Royals, and then next week's show, I'm pretty sure we're going to talk about how the Royals woke up the
they
Sox
have,
bats.
They have the Royals,
and the Sox are all good.
Royals Monday, Tuesday, two games against the Tigers, which I don't understand the whole logic behind two game series. It just doesn't really seem to make much sense to me. But they got a two game set against the Royals, two game set against the Tigers, and then three games against your Los Angeles Angels.
And I will be in attendance of all three games. Nice. More importantly, this is regular season baseball. A team I happen to enjoy made the playoffs. We're talking about the Chicago Bulls. You could go to TalkBulls.com and talk about them. But I am going to quickly discuss what was a pretty impressive win against the Miami Heat, the bastards of the East, the defending NBA champions, James Posey, the thug, Shaquille O'Neal, the most likable big man ever, Dwayne Wade, how can you not like Dwayne Wade and his toughness? And then there's Kirk Heinrich and his 7 minutes in the first three quarters being in major foul trouble, Ben Gordon and his god-awful offensive series and drives and shots. God, he was trying to give the game away. But then there was Luol Deng, the London assassin.
Luol, the London assassin.
Coming in huge. Winning the game for the Bulls. Ben Wallace playing tremendous defense. Cephalosha, not Chris Duhon, getting the bulk of the minutes when Heinrich was out, doing a smothering job on Dwayne Wade, one of the future stars of the NBA and
you
already a star.
You sound like Dick Vitale. Take it easy.
A diaper dandy, let me tell you.
It was
Cephalosha, wow, wow, wow. Tyrus Thomas, that type of explosiveness. How can you not love it?
All right. Take it easy.
Dick
it was Vitale, nice.
Baby, I'm out. You can
Bulls,
check me
Bulls,
out on ESPN.com.
The Bulls did take that first game, and they'll play the next game. I think is the second game set for June? I think June 5th is when they play game two, right?
June 5th,
I think, is when they play game two.
June is in, like, a couple months from
now? I know. I'm thinking, well, the NBA likes to rest up its stars, so I'm thinking they want to make sure there's, like, 2 months between each game in the playoffs, right?
That way Wade's shoulders 100%.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thing.
Yeah, makes sense.
They play Saturday, they're off Sunday, off today, and they play tomorrow.
Well, today is Sunday.
Horrible concept. Just get the games going. Focus on the depth. Man, if the Bulls played on a Saturday, and then they played on a Sunday, and then they were off on a Monday, and then they played on a Tuesday and a Wednesday, they have so much depth, they would win it. No problem. But no, NBA doesn't want to do it that way. They want to make things difficult. They want to drag it out. They want to make it boring.
They want that
it's
month and a half long playoff run. Hey, you know it's not boring? The Bulls winning.
I wasn't able to watch Saturday's game, so I can't comment on it at all. I saw that they won, and I saw some highlights. I know Tyrus Thomas had a little bit of a moment. He blocked a couple shots, so it was, I'm sure, very exciting.
Best part, he blocked a couple shots, went down, Chris Duhon fed him for an alley-oop, and slam-a-jammed it home.
The
big man that showed up. But Andres Nocioni, he's shown why the Bulls need to bring him back, unless they trade him somehow for a big man in like a sign-and-trade type deal. Because this is a second straight playoff run where he's shown up. And I know it's just one game,
but he's hurt.
In big.
I mean,
he
just came back
shots.
A couple weeks ago from an injury. The fact that he was able to go out there and I think he had 17 or what 20 points or close to it, that's pretty damn impressive for a guy who is still trying to recover.
El Chapo. We're going to end the show on El Chapo because how can you top that? So we'll be back next week. I may be here, Mario may be here, but both of us, we will not be
here. You know
what?
If you'd like to see one or the other, just email Jason. You got the email. Email Jason. Let us know if you don't want him or you don't want me. Maybe you don't want both. Maybe you'd rather just come and do it yourself and find your own guest and be a jerk. That's fine. But it's one of us, I'm thinking. So vote one of us off for next week. And we'll do that.
Vote Sanjaya off, not us. What's Sanjaya?
He's already out.
Oh, good. Does that mean the American people can instead vote for a president? Because the last 2 weeks of American Idol, more people voted for that than the president's race. That is disgraceful, ladies and gentlemen. You, the people, are disgraceful. So check us out this week. Listen to this show. Obviously, you've listened to us. You've listened this far. And then come back next week and listen to whoever's on there. We'll be back. Thank you.